Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Of course, thrillers are one of our favorite genres. In my research to bring you new and notable titles, I was struck by a brilliant new group of psychological dramas. These books seem wonderfully intense, darker, yes, but thought-provoking and intellectually satisfying. So let's start our exploration as we turn to page one of the book report. Powerful players, ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. Freud's Mistress by Karen Mack and Jennifer Kaufman is a page-turning novel inspired by the true-life love affair between Sigmund Freud and his sister-in-law. In Vienna at the end of the 19th century, Minna Bernays finds herself out on the street and out of options. Though the city is aswirl with avant-garde artists and revolutionary ideas, a woman's only hope for security is still marriage. But Minna is unwilling to settle. She turns to her sister Martha for help. Martha has her own problems, 6 young children, and an absent, disinterested husband who happens to be Sigmund Freud. At this time, Freud is a struggling professor, shunned by his peers and under attack for his theories, most of which center around sexual impulses. And while Martha is repulsed by her husband's pornographic work, Minna is fascinated. Minna and Freud embark on what is at first an intellectual courtship, yet something deeper is brewing beneath the surface. Suzanne Torin narrates this fascinating blend of fact and fiction.
When the night maid finally appeared, Minna brushed past her in a fury. Took bloody long enough, she thought, but murmured a perfunctory good evening, and descended a dimly lit stairway to the basement kitchen. She carefully placed her bundle on a cot near the beast, the enormous black furnace by the scullery. A frail, drowsy child emerged from the blankets and sat there silently as Minna pushed the cot closer to the furnace, slid the thin mattress back on its frame, and settled the child beneath a feeble candle flickering on a wooden shelf. "Fräulein Bernet, you're wanted upstairs. The mistress has been ringing for over an hour," the night maid said, adjusting her starched white cap. "Everyone suffers when you run about," she added, sighing heavily as she bent over and wiped a mud print from the stairs. "I told the mistress you went for a walk, but she wasn't having any of it, said you must have gone somewhere." "If you must know, we've been out gargling gin, haven't we, Flora?"
"Yes, Fräulein," Flora said with a weak smile. "And then we went to the doctor."
"The child's delirious," Minna said. "Cover up, dear, it's freezing in here." There was a draft coming from somewhere that made her long for dry clothes, and her head was pounding. She put her hand in her skirt pocket and fingered the brown paper parcel of medicine. Thank God, still there. Earlier that day, Minna had discovered Flora in a terrible state, attempting to do her chores, but coughing so hard it brought her to her knees. Several times, Minna had dunked the pathetic little thing, wailing and hiccuping, in a cold bath to break the fever, but nothing seemed to work. The child was doomed, her cheeks shining with fever, the sweating sickness getting worse and worse. Minna could stand it no longer. She bundled her up, and without a word to anyone, set out to take the child to the doctor.
"My throat hurts,"
Flora whimpered, struggling for breath, as Minna rang the bell at the physician's office. "He'll take care of you," she answered, with an air of conviction she did not feel. "You are the Baroness's charge, and very important."
An elderly gentleman appeared in the doorway, blotting his mustache with a linen napkin. Minna could see a woman sitting at the dining table across the room, and there was an aroma of boiled beef and wine.
Herr Doctor, my employer, the Baroness Wolf, wishes immediate treatment for this child. She is most concerned.
The doctor hesitated a moment as Minna pushed by him, launching into a litany of the child's ailments. Fever, coughing, nausea, loss of appetite. There was little reason to doubt her authority. Even without her overcoat and despite the muck on her clothes, she was an elegant woman. Willowy, with a straight back, smooth skin, and perfect diction. In addition, she was a most convincing liar.
Could she possibly have scarlet fever? Minna asked as the doctor led her to his offices in the back.
Unspecified infection, he concluded after an examination. Bed rest for at least a month. Linens changed twice a week. Lozenges for the sore throat. And Bayer's heroin for her cough.
Minna listened, nodding her head in agreement, all the while knowing what the doctor advised would be impossible to carry out in this household. In any event, how in heaven's name did Minna ever think she could get away with this? Her days, her evenings, even her Sundays, belonged to the Baroness. She was expected to serve at the pleasure of her employer, and tardiness often meant instant dismissal.
We have just heard Freud's Mistress by Karen Mack and Jennifer Kaufman. At this point in her career, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, Meg Wolitzer deserves to be a household name. Meg studied creative writing at Smith College and graduated from Brown. She wrote her first novel, Sleepwalking, a story of college girls obsessed with poetry and death while still an undergraduate. More books followed, including Surrender Dorothy, made into a TV movie starring Diane Keaton, The 10-Year Nap, and The Uncoupling. Her short fiction has been featured in Best American Short Stories and the Pushcart Prize. Meg's written two novels for younger readers and co-authored a book of cryptic crosswords. Meg has taught creative writing at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop and Skidmore College. She currently lives in New York with her husband and two sons. Today, we'll speak to her about her newest novel, The Interestings, selected by Amazon as one of their top 10 books of spring 2013. Welcome, Meg. It's so great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you.
I love The Interestings. When I was deep into it, the phrase meaty popped into my head. There's so much to chew on, so satisfying. Tell us about the story by introducing us to the main characters.
Well, the story starts at a summer camp in 1974, which is the summer that Richard Nixon resigned. And Jules Jacobson, who is called Julie Jacobson at the beginning of the book, is a girl whose father has died, and she really doesn't know anything about anything. And she goes off to this camp and meets these unbelievably interesting kids. And it sort of sets the stage for the rest of her life.
And tell us about Ethan and Ash and Jonah.
Well, Ethan Figman is an animator, and he's a very homely boy, and he's very funny and brilliant and kind. And he falls in love with Julie, Jules, but she can't really love him back, but he becomes her great friend over the course of the book. And Ash is the best friend, the beautiful, beautiful girl who Jules meets there. And her brother is named Goodman, and there is another friend named Jonah, who is the son of a famous folk singer named Susanna Bay.
Do you see yourself in any of the main characters or elements of each?
Well, a writer is always the sort of god of the book and therefore contains multitudes, I guess. But you have to kind of understand and love the characters in some way, even if they're horrible, in order to know them. So I guess parts of myself are certainly in there, absolutely.
One of the central themes of the book is early talent and the ways in which, whether or not you pursue it, it weaves in and out of your life. Talk about that.
Well, there's different kinds of talent. And Ethan, in fact, somebody who really to my thinking, represents the sort of kind of talent you can't give anybody. You're sort of born with it and you can sort of nourish it. But he is a real brilliant, original talent. And then there are other people in the book who find that their talents don't add up over time, not enough to make a life out of. I mean, when you're young, if somebody's good in a play in school or a camp, you think, oh, they're going to be famous. You think the world works that way, or at least I thought the world worked that way. But of course, nothing is linear. Nothing really works in such a straight line way. And talented girls at a summer camp might end up as a sales, you know, as sales clerks or doctors or something having nothing to do with their early talent. But I think that specialness is so important to these kids and was so important to a lot of us growing up.
Of course, another central theme is money and how money can change a friendship. Why did you choose to write about this?
Well, I think money and class are so much of a part of our lives. And, you know, we like to think that people's fates sort of are always hinging on hard work. But a lot of it is about connections and money and how you started out. You know, we don't start out evenly, even though it might be nice to sort of think that we do. I mean, what Jules didn't understand is that her friends, some of her friends from New York City, she was from the suburbs, some of her friends from New York City really had so many more advantages and that their lives were going to take a different path from hers, in part because of that. So money is just always there. It's greasing everything. It's changing things. And I feel that it's, if I'm writing a book that takes place in New York, money is going to have to be a part of it.
I loved when Jules asked Ethan, how do you know how to behave rich? Does the knowledge arrive with the money?
Yeah, because when they started out and he was just this kind of funny looking boy who only cared about making his cartoons, who could have thought really that he would end up, you know, the head of basically running an empire, a kind of Simpsons TV show like empire based on his cartoon that he came up with as a kid. So he, who is not materialistic, has all this money and access. So she really wants to know, you know, what's it like? How do you know? How do you know how to do it? You're no different from me. Would I know how to do it?
Can you be someone's best friend and still envy their success?
Yes, you can, because I think that most people are not pure of heart. And by which I mean we're human. I mean, our egos get in the way. If somebody tells you, oh my God, this wonderful thing happened to me, and you love that person, your first thought is, that's wonderful. But occasionally your second thought is, oh, I wish that happened to me. Or you feel a pang and you maybe hate yourself for it. But I think that it's very, very hard for most people to divorce themselves from their egos. The ego is sort of like a moose head on a hunting lodge, kind of, you know, just sort of jutting into the middle of the room. And we kind of can't help it.
Talk a little about your journey and any tips that you would offer aspiring writers.
I've been doing this for a really long time. I mean, I sold my first novel when I was a senior in college in 1981. And I've sort of been in the trenches of writing, you know. I mean, they're pretty cushy trenches there. I'm very, very fortunate to be living and working as a writer today. But I think that I was talking to a writer friend about what among the students we've had, because I do teach quite a bit intermittently, what they had in common, the ones who really went on to be writers, to sort of make a living as writers. I don't mean to be writers. I mean to really sort of be able to do it in a way and be recognized for their work. And I think that what it was that they worked all the time. It was kind of as simple as that. They just worked all the time. They just tried to figure it out. And if I look back on my own work, like when I write, when I'm in the middle of a book, I'm writing all the time. And when I'm not, I'm thinking about writing. But when after I spend a day working, now because of all this technology that's basically ruining our lives in some ways, but aiding them in many others, I'll sort of send myself the work that I've done during the day and look at it on the subway on my iPhone, where it's been made to look like a little Kindle book. So it actually looks sort of the way that it would look on the page. And I can see things a little differently when I'm not at my computer, when I can't actually start typing and changing things. So I'm thinking about the characters all the time and I'm, you know, have a notepad by my bed. But I would just say keep working, because you know, if you get very discouraged and don't work a lot and just sort of take months off in the middle of a book, it's very, very hard, I think, for anybody to maintain the thread. The thread is an obsessive one. You know, when you're writing, when you're writing, you really do want to be just so involved in it. It's kind of like a love affair. It's the thing you want to be doing all the time.
So you're not one of these writers who has this 5-hour routine block in the middle of the day, or 8 to 12, or 1 to 5?
I wish I did. I mean, when my children were young, I would work when they were sleeping, or I would work, you know, the minute they went off to school. I sometimes kept banker's hours, because it's just, it is diminishing returns after a certain point, because we're human, our blood sugars drop, we get cranky, we need distractions. The morning has always been a really excellent time. I rarely have written into the evening. I just kind of like to give myself a break after working all day. But I do, I mean, it's, if I look at it, it's fairly consistent and regular. It's like a, you know, a full solid work day during work periods. But no, it can occupy different times of day.
Talk about your music for a bit.
Oh, my music. Well, that's I feel a little bit of a fraud doing that, but I will. I do like to sing and play guitar a little bit and write music. And I was very fortunate enough to become good friends with Suzzy Roach, formerly of the Roaches, if some of you know their wonderful, wonderful music. And she and I just sort of began collaborating, and we set the first pages of some books to music, sort of as a joke. But from there, it became something more serious. And we're actually teaching a class together at Princeton in the fall, and that involves music and adaptation and fiction and all kinds of things.
So it's not, are you doing a CD together that someone could look for?
No. That is really a premature thought. But no, that's not on the agenda.
All right. Talk about Nutcracker's devilishly addictive mind twisters for the insatiably verbiferous.
Wow. You've really done your homework. That is an old thing. I've created crossword puzzles, not the kind of standard ones where the answer is, you know, actress Merkel, Una, but cryptic puzzles and puns and anagrams with my collaborator, Jesse Green, many, many years ago. We did a book of these, but it's been a really, really long time. It's long out of print, but I love crossword puzzles very much.
All right. What's next for you?
I'm just beginning another novel, and I'm not at the point where I really know exactly what shape it's going to take. And I'm sort of enjoying the freedom of thinking about it, but I know what I'll even like more is the period that I describe when I've thought and thought and thought about it, and I've decided to actually commit some of it to page, and then I'll sort of print it out and go sit in a coffee shop somewhere and sort of cross out most of it and finally figure out, oh, this is what I'm writing. And that's the happiest time.
Well, Meg and listeners, I want to say that I think The Interestings is one of my top 3 books this year. I loved it. And I really want to thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Elaine, so much.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of The Interestings, narrated by Jen Tulock.
Talent, that slippery thing, had been the frequent subject of dinner conversation between Edie and Manny Wunderlich for over half a century. They never tired of it, and if someone studied word frequency in the dialogue of this now elderly couple, they might note that talent kept appearing. Though really, Manny Wunderlich thought, as he sat in the underheated dining room of the big gray house off-season, occasionally when they said it, they meant success. "She became a great talent," his wife was saying as she served him a spoonful of potato, banging the spoon against his plate to release it, though it apparently did not want to be released. When they first met in Greenwich Village at a party in 1946, she was a modern dancer, and she leapt around her bedroom on Perry Street wearing just a bedsheet with ivy twined in her hair. In bed, the calloused bottoms of her feet were sharp against his legs. Edie was a gorgeous avant-garde girl back in the day when that could be a full-time occupation, but in marriage, she slowly became less wild. To Manny's great disappointment, though, her domestic skills didn't rise to the fore as her sexual and artistic ones receded. Edie proved to be a dreadful cook, and throughout their life together, the food she prepared was often like poison. When they opened Spirit in the Woods in 1952, they both knew that finding an excellent cook would be essential to the enterprise. If the food wasn't good, then no one would want to come. Edie's shy second cousin, Ida Steinberg, a survivor of that other kind of camp, as someone had tastelessly said, was hired, and in the summertime the Wunderlichs ate like royalty. But in the off-season, when Ida only worked occasionally for special events, they generally ate like two people in a gulag. Glutinous stews, potatoes in various iterations. The food was bad, but the conversation was vigorous as they sat and talked about many of the campers who had come through these stone gates and slept in these teepees. Lately, as the year 2009 came to a close, they could no longer remember all of them, or even most of them, but the coin-bright ones shone through the murk of the Wunderlich's memory. Manny had unconsciously begun grouping the campers over the decades into categories. All he needed was a name, and then the thought process and classification could begin. "Who became a great talent?" he asked. "Mona Vandersteen. You remember her. She came for 3 summers. "Mona Vandersteen. Dance," he suddenly thought. "Dance?" he said tentatively. His wife looked at him, frowning. Her hair was as white as his hair and his out-of-control eyebrows, and he could not believe that this thick, tough old pigeon was the same girl who'd loved him the way she had done back on Perry Street just after the Second World War. The only part that now remained of that slight, flexible girl was the cheese-grater texture of the heels of her feet. Her body had been stocky since the early 1960s, and it wasn't childbirth that had done this. The Wunderlichs had been unable to conceive. And though there was pain in this fact, it had been blunted over time by all the teenagers who came through Spirit in the Woods. Edie, back in late middle age, seemed to have been physically rebuilt in the image of a pyramid. No, she was built, Manny realized one day, like one of the teepees they could see out their window across the road. One of the teepees that had lasted all this time and never needed repair, never needed anything, because they were so primitive and basic and self-contained. Mona Vandersteen was not a dancer, Edie said now. Think again. Manny closed his eyes and thought. Various girls from camp obediently appeared before him, like the muses.
That was The Interestings by Meg Wolitzer. Powerful players. Ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Of the many literary awards out there, the Man Booker Prize is a Book Report favorite. John Banville has been the recipient of this prestigious award and now offers up a new novel, Ancient Light. Is there any difference between memory and invention? That's the question that fuels this story, and it's the question that haunts Alexander Cleve as he dwells on the memories of his first and only love. He, at age 15, the woman more than twice his age, and the mother of his best friend. And then there's Cleve's daughter, lost to a madness of mind and heart he cannot comprehend. When his stunted acting career is suddenly, inexplicably revived with a movie role portraying a man who may not be who he says he is, his young leading lady unwittingly gives him the opportunity to see the chasm between the doing of a thing and the recollection of what was done. Robin Sachs narrates.
I'm thinking of the morning after the very first one of Lydia's nocturnal rampages, when she had started up from the pillow, convinced our recently dead Cass was alive and in the house somewhere. Even when the panic was over and we had dragged ourselves back to bed, we did not get to sleep again, not properly. Lydia doing hiccupy after sobs and my heart tom-tomming away, but lay on the bed on our backs for a long time, as if practicing to be the corpses that one day we shall be. The curtains were thick and drawn tightly shut, and I did not realize the dawn had come up until I saw forming above me a brightly shimmering image that spread itself until it stretched over almost the entire ceiling. At first I took it for an hallucination, generated out of my sleep-deprived and still half-frantic consciousness. Also, I could not make head or tail of it, which is not surprising, for the image, as after a moment or two I saw, was upside down. What was happening was that a pinhole-sized opening between the curtains was letting in a narrow beam of light that had turned the room into a camera obscura, and the image above us was an inverted, dawn-fresh picture of the world outside. There was the road below the window, with its blueberry-blue tarmac, and nearer in, a shiny black hump that was part of the roof of our car, and the single silver birch across the way, slim and shivery as a naked girl, and beyond all that, the bay, pinched between the finger and thumb of its two piers, the north one and the south, and then the distant, paler azure of the sea, that at the invisible horizon became imperceptibly sky. How clear it all was, how sharply limned. I could see the sheds along the north pier, their asbestos roofs dully agleam in the early sunlight, and in the lee of the south pier, the bristling amber-coloured masts of the sailboats jostling together at anchor there. I fancied I could even make out the little waves on the sea, with here and there a gay speckle of foam. Thinking still that I might be dreaming or deluded, I asked Lydia if she could see this luminous mirage, and she said yes, yes, and reached out and clutched my hand tightly. We spoke in whispers, as if the very action of our voices might shatter the frail assemblage of light and spectral colour above us. The thing seemed to vibrate inside itself, to be tinily a-tremble everywhere, as if it were the teeming particles of light itself, the streaming photons that we were seeing, which I suppose it was, strictly speaking. Yet surely, we felt, surely this was not entirely a natural phenomenon, for which there would be a perfectly simple scientific explanation, preceded by a soft little cough and followed by an apologetic hum. Surely this was a thing given to us, a gift, a greeting. In other words, a sure sign, sent to comfort us. We lay there, watching it, awestruck, for, oh, I do not know how long. As the sun rose, the inverted world above us was setting, retreating along the ceiling until it developed a hinge at one edge, and began sliding steadily down the far wall, and poured itself at last into the carpet, and was gone. Straight away we got up, what else was there to do, and started our dealings with the day. Were we comforted? Did we feel lightened? A little, until the wonder of the spectacle to which we had been treated began to diffuse, to slip and slide and be absorbed into the ordinary fibrous texture of things. It was by the coast, too, that our daughter died, another coast, at Porto Venere, which is, if you do not know it, an ancient Ligurian seaport at the tip of a spit of land stretching out into the Gulf of Genoa, opposite Lerici, where the poet Shelley drowned. The Romans knew it as Portus Veneris, for long ago there was a shrine to that charming goddess on the drear promontory where now stands the Church of St. Peter the Apostle.
That was Ancient Light by John Banville. Summer in Red Hook, Brooklyn, an isolated blue-collar neighborhood. Bored and listless, 15-year-olds June and Val are looking for fun. Val wants to do something a little wild and crazy. They take a raft out onto the bay. But out on the water, during the humid night, the girls disappear. Only Val survives, washing ashore, bruised and unconscious. This shocking event echoes through the lives of Red Hook's diverse residents. Val contends with the shadow of her missing friend and a truth she's buried deep inside. In Visitation Street, Ivy Pakoda combines prose with psychological insight to explore a cast of solitary souls pulled by family, love, betrayal, and hope. Ray Porter narrates.
The girls, once a matched set, now seem to be fashioned from different material. Val, whose pale skin repels the sun, is made of reeds and twigs, like the sad saplings planted in the park that shoot up but never seem to leaf out. June, blessed with an olive complexion even in winter, is formed from something soft and pliant, clay maybe, or cookie dough. Somewhere, Val suspects, there may be boys who admire her bamboo limbs, but out in Red Hook everyone goes for June's generous shape, her elastic breasts and rear that she seems to re-sculpt every night, giving the neighborhood something fresh to look at. Even her wavy brown hair appears mischievous in the way it curls and bounces. Val's hair, an unremarkable straw color, strikes her as lacking in enthusiasm. Val knows that time is short for kids' stuff. When school starts, they'll be expected to turn up at parties, looking on point, made up and polished. But sometimes Val can't restrain her silliness. After being cooped up in that daycare, she wants to be naughty. Not that in-your-face naughtiness of scoring a bottle of something sweet and alcoholic or sneaking a cigarette. What she's after is a prankish secret the girls can share someday when they are on some guy's couch, tipsy or even high. The window is open wide. June's positioned herself near it and hops to her feet each time she hears footsteps. She stretches out her arms, grasping either side of the window frame. "I'm gonna get my groove on tonight," she says loud enough for anyone passing to hear. "I'm gonna turn it up." She rotates her hips and thrusts her chest forward. Her shorts strain at the seams. Val worries that if June arches her back another inch, the whole package is going to burst. "I'm going to show them how it's done," she says. Something about June's posture reminds Val of a bag of microwave popcorn. She falls back on her bed, her laughter pouring out into the street. "Baby," June says. "You laugh like a baby." She leaves the window, flops down on the bed, but keeps her distance from Val. She checks her nails and pulls out her phone. "Let's do something." "We could camp out on the roof," Val says. June does not look up. "Or watch a movie. You want the world thinking we're babies forever?" "There's nothing wrong with movies." June stands up. "I'm getting us a drink." 5 minutes later, June returns with a half-empty bottle of alcoholic lemonade. "Did you pick up someone's empty?" Val says. "I drank half on my way up." "We could take the raft out," Val says. "It's something." June finishes the drink. The rubber raft was a gift from a crew of older guys who'd taunted and teased them and finally made a play for the girls at the pool last weekend. What they wanted with a hot pink rubber raft, Val and June didn't know, but they took their prize. Tonight, hot and stir-crazy, Val decides what the raft is for. Take a float in the bay. Cool off. See what's what from the water. The girls hit the street, the raft bumping awkwardly against their legs as they walk. "It's your raft. You carry it," June says, dropping her end. Late summer smells hang in the air. Ripe sewers, cookouts, and the scent of stagnant water that lingers in Red Hook, no matter the season. The night echoes with other people's noise, laughter falling from windows, and the call and response of competing boomboxes. The girls approach Coffee Park at the edge of the Red Hook housing project. June's walking a few steps ahead, putting a couple of feet between her and Val and the raft.
That was a sample of Visitation Street by Ivy Pakoda. Powerful players,
ruthless politicians, intrigue, and passion. In The Tangled Web, author J.P. Lane takes you on a suspense-packed global trek fraught with paid assassins and deadly plots. Who will be snared in this network of murder and mayhem? Grab The Tangled Web and find out at Kindle stores and iBookstore worldwide. Reviews and more at jp-lane.com. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Is A.N. Dyer? The Book Report finds out in this Newsday summer reading pick, And Sons, by David Gilbert. It's the deeply affecting story of an iconic novelist, two interconnected families, and the heartbreaking truths that fiction can hide. The funeral of Charles Henry Topping on Manhattan's Upper East Side would have been a minor affair, but for the presence of one particular mourner, the notorious reclusive author A.N. Dyer, whose novel Ampersand is a classic of American teenage angst. But as Dyer delivers the eulogy for his oldest friend, he suffers a breakdown over the life he's led, the people he's hurt, and the novel that will forever be his legacy. He realizes he must gather his three sons for the first time in many years before it's too late. George Newbern narrates.
And there he sat, up front, all alone in the first pew. For those who asked, the ushers confirmed it with a reluctant nod. Yep, that's him. For those who cared but said nothing, they gave themselves away by staring sideways and pretending to be impressed by the nearby stained glass, as if devotees of Cornelius the Centurion or Godfrey of Bouillon instead of a 79-year-old writer with gout. Rumor had it he might show. His oldest and dearest friend, Charles Henry Topping, was dead. Funeral on Tuesday at St. James on 71st and Madison. Be respectful, dress appropriately. See you there. Some of the faithful brought books in hopes of getting them signed. A long shot, but who could resist? And by 10:45, the church was almost full. I myself remember watching friends of my father as they walked down that aisle, while they glimpsed the Slocums and the Coopers, and over there, the Englehearts. Hello, by way of regretful grin. A number of these fellow mourners baffled them. Were those sneakers? Was that a necklace or a tattoo? A hairdo or a hat? It seemed death had an unfortunate bride's side. Once seated, all and sundry leafed through the program. Good paper, nicely engraved. Engaged the running time in their head, which mercifully lacked a communion. There was a universal thrill for the eulogist, since the man up front was notoriously private, bordering on reclusive. Excitement spread via church-wide mutter. Thumbs composed emails, texts, status updates, tweets. This New York funeral suddenly constituted a chance cultural event, one of those I-was-there moments, so prized in this city, even if you had known the writer from way back, knew him before he was famous and won all those awards, knew him as a strong ocean swimmer and an epic climber of trees, knew his mother and his father, his stepfather, knew his childhood friends, all of whom knew him as Andy or Andrew, rather than the more unknowable A.N. Dyer. All this happened in mid-March, 12 years ago. I recall it being the first warm day of the year, a small relief after months of near-impossible cold. Just a week earlier, the temperature sulked in the teens, the wind chill dragging the brat into newborn territory. Windows rattled in their sashes, and the sky resembled a headfirst plunge onto cement. After a long winter of dying, my father was finally dead. I remember standing up and covering his face like they do in the movies, his bright blue socks poking free from the bottom of the comforter. He always wore socks with his pajamas and never bothered to sleep under the sheets. It was as if his dreams had no right to unmake a bed. I went over and opened both windows, no longer cursing the draft, but hoping the cold might shelter his body for a bit. But on the day of his funeral, the city seemed near sweltering. Even if the thermostat within St. James maintained its autumnal chill, the Episcopalian constant of Scotch and Tweed. Churches are glorified attics, A.N. Dyer once wrote. But now he resembled a worshiper deep in prayer, head lowered, hands crammed against stomach. His posture reminded me of a comma, its intent not yet determined. People assumed he was upset. Of course he was upset. He and my father were the oldest of friends, born just 11 days apart in the same Manhattan hospital. Growing up, this minor divide seemed important, with Andrew teasing the older Charlie that he was destined to die first. It was just basic actuarial math. And Andrew would bury his friend and live his remaining numbered days in a glorious, topping-free state. "The worms and creepy crawlies will eat you while I swig champagne." This joke carried on until the punchline became infused with intimacy, and what once made young Charlie cry now made him smile, even toward the end. "You really are milking this," Andrew muttered during his final visit. "I've had the bubbly on ice for a month now." He sat by the bed, like a benched player witnessing an awful defeat. My father was no longer speaking. That bully with the scythe straddled his chest and dared him to breathe. "Come on, breathe."
We've just heard And Sons by David Gilbert.
Macbeth, a novel, brings the grit of the psychological thriller to Shakespeare's tale of political intrigue, treachery, and murder. In this full-length novel written exclusively for audio, authors A.J. Hartley, a Shakespeare professor at the University of North Carolina, and author David Hewson rethink literature's most infamous married couple. This is an edgy new take on Macbeth. Actor Alan Cumming performs the story of whispering in shadows, witchcraft in an ancient landscape, and the desperate struggle of flawed people to do what they think is right.
The pair scatter separately through the mist and thickets like malevolent ghosts, the crone low and swift on her black sticks, the other a tall, hunched, muscular figure, that of a sullen thief out for booty. The young one stays there, hidden by the gorse and thistle, smelling the earth and the blood beyond, peering towards the battle and the tall, commanding figure in its midst. "That warrior is in heat," she murmurs, "as am I. Macbeth. Macbeth." "Macbeth?" The man didn't turn. He was listening. Some far-off sound caught on the cold, wet air at the very edge of hearing. "Macbeth!" "Speak," he answered, wiping the blood and sweat from his face. Whatever it was, the words were gone, or perhaps nothing more than one more fleeting illusion, a passing ghost in the midst of battle. "There's a fleet landed down the loch," said the sergeant, a heavy man who always looked as if he'd spent the night in a ditch. "Vikings came under cover of night from the west through the Sound of Mull. A raiding party, an unwelcome though not infrequent visitation upon Scotland, like pestilence or fleas. Where are they now?" "The first boats are docking at Inverlochy. The men in the castle have fled already. There were scarcely 20 soldiers anyway. The rest are with the king, on the far side, almost at Loch Ness." The absent king. Why had it taken Duncan so long to cross the Highlands from his eastern base in Forres and join the fight against the rebels in the west? Now there were two fronts, two enemies, the Scottish traitors and the Norsemen. He could picture the new battleground, Inverlochy, a handsome village in the foothills of Ben Nevis, 15 miles in a short loch crossing from the insurgent castle at Ballachulish they now besieged. Thanks to that brief stretch of water which Macbeth's boats commanded, they had a little time to spare between the present battle and the next. He nodded and looked back to the hill fort around which his men had hunkered down, their eyes on its smoking battlements, set on an expansive crag of grey slate, trying to picture the forces gathering around him. The great glen ran like a diagonal sword slash across the neck of Scotland, from Inverness in the northeast to Loch Linnhe in the south, past purple and dun heather hills beside ribbon splashes of jewelled water. Macbeth and his men had spent the best part of a month chasing and killing MacDonald's treacherous army the length of it. His soldiers were weary to be home, and so was he. This fighting needed to be brought to a close. MacDonald's inside, thought Macbeth, his stomach clenching, jaw tightening. This is his final stand, inside and peering through a slit window with his dogs at his heels. The Vikings must wait or do their worst. I've no time to deal with bandits. Once the rebellion's over... My lord, said the sergeant. He turned and caught something behind the soldier's eyes, a flicker of apprehension or dread. These are no bandits. Sweno, the King of Norway himself, is with them. They mean to stay. The man's eyes flickered and dropped to the rain-sodden heather, his face reddening. To stay? How do you know? Demanded Macbeth. They sacked a village on Mull, left a single survivor to make sure word got out. They seemed sure they could divide our force either side of Inverlochy. How... Macbeth knew the beautiful island in the Hebrides and could imagine the devastation and death the Vikings would bring, as always. The ruined sheepcotes and shattered fishing boats, the smell of smoking thatches and chicken coops, weeping women and spilt blood. He turned into the stiff breeze and blinked before letting his gaze return to the rough stone tower with its crumbling curtain wall set on the grey slate scarp.
That was Macbeth, a novel by A.J. Hartley and David Hewson. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Rose Baker seals men's fates. With a few strokes of the keys, she can send a person away to prison for life. A typist in the New York City Police Department, Rose is like a high priestess. Confessions are her job. It's 1923, and while she may hear every detail about shootings, knifings, and murders, as soon as she leaves the interrogation room, she's once again the weaker sex. Suzanne Rindle's The Other Typist is the story of a new era for women. Gone are the Victorian standards of what is acceptable. Rose is surrounded by women who bob their hair, smoke, and go to speakeasies. Yet prudish Rose is stuck in the fading light of yesteryear, searching for the nurturing companionship that eluded her childhood. When glamorous O'Dally, a new girl, joins the typing pool, Rose falls under her spell. As the two women navigate between the sparkling underworld of speakeasies by night and their work at the station by day, Rose is drawn fully into a high-stakes world. And soon, her fascination turns into an obsession from which she may never recover. Gretchen Moll narrates.
Typing is not a brutish, masculinizing sort of work, mind you. In fact, one might even go so far as to argue that the work of a typist, the simple act of taking dictation, the crisp dance of fingertips with their dainty staccato over the shorthand keys, is perhaps one of the most civilized forms of work our modern world has to offer. And they needn't worry about the rest of it. A good typist knows her place. She is simply happy, as a woman, to be paid a reasonable income. In any case, If typing were truly a masculine activity, you would see more men doing it. And of course you don't. It is always women one sees typing, so it only follows that it must be an activity more suited to them. I have, in all my time, only met one male typist, and that particular gentleman's delicate constitution was even lesser equipped than my own for working in a police precinct. I should have known from the first he would not stay long. He had the nervous carriage of a small bird, and his mustache looked as though it was trimmed daily by a barber. He wore a pair of very well-kept white spats over his shoes. On his second day, a criminal expectorated a large stream of tobacco juice on them. The male typist, I'm sorry to report, turned very pale and excused himself to go to the lavatory. He only stayed one more week after that. "White spats," the sergeant had remarked, shaking his head. The sergeant's clucking is often his manner of confiding in me. "White spats have no place here," he said, and I knew he was probably glad to be rid of such a dandy. Of course, I did not point out to the sergeant that the lieutenant detective also wears white spats. The lieutenant detective and the sergeant are two very different sorts of men, but they appear to have long ago struck an uneasy alliance. It has always been my distinct impression that I am not to outwardly tip my favor in the direction of either man, lest it upset the tenuous balance that allows for their cooperation. But if I am being honest, I will tell you I feel more at ease around the sergeant. He is older and perhaps a little fonder of me than a married man ought to be, but I feel it is a fatherly sort of fondness and that he became a police sergeant in the first place because he is a righteous man and he honestly believes it is his mission to uphold the proper order of our great city. Moreover, the sergeant likes all things to keep proper order and takes great pride in following all rules to the letter. Just last month, he suspended one of the officers, sentencing the man to a whole week without pay because the officer had given a homeless waif who was waiting in the holding cell a ham sandwich. I could see why maybe the officer did it. The vagabond was such a sad spectacle, the outline of his ribs whispered indiscreetly against the thin cloth of his shirt, and his eyes rolled like haunted marbles caught in two deep, dark sockets. No one accused the sergeant of being unchristian, but I believe he could tell some of the other men were thinking it. "Feeding such a man only sends the message that there is no profit in hard work and following the rules, and we can't afford to bankrupt these ideas," the sergeant reminded us. The lieutenant detective outranks the sergeant, but you would never know it. While he can certainly intimidate others at will, the sergeant is not a tall man, although he is large in other ways. The great bulk of his weight sits around his waist, just over the rim of his uniform trousers, giving him a reassuringly paternal paunch. His handlebar mustache has taken on a sprinkling of salt and pepper in recent years. He wears it curled and also lets his sideburns grow long, which is no longer in keeping with the latest fashion. But the sergeant cares little for changing fashions, and he does not go in at all for the newest shocking ones. Once, while he was reading a newspaper, I heard him idly remark that today's modern fashions are proof of our nation's degeneration. By way of contrast, the lieutenant detective has no mustache and keeps his face clean-shaven, which happens to be rather in fashion these days. Also in fashion is the haphazard style with which he combs his hair back using hair cream. Almost always, a lock or two comes loose and falls quavering over one eye, only to have him run a hand through his hair and push it back up.
We've just heard The Other Typist by Suzanne Rindel. Imagine that your husband wrote you a letter to be opened after his death. Imagine, too, the letter contains his deepest, darkest secret, something with the potential to destroy not just the life you've built, but the lives of others. Imagine, then, you stumble across that letter while your husband is still very much alive. In Leanne Moriarty's The Husband's Secret, Cecilia Fitzpatrick has achieved it all. She's a successful businesswoman, a pillar of her community, and a devoted wife and mother. But that letter is about to change everything, and not just for her. Carolyn Lee performs this gripping novel.
It was all because of the Berlin Wall.
If it wasn't for the Berlin Wall, Cecilia would never have found the letter. And then she wouldn't be sitting here, at the kitchen table, willing herself not to rip it open. The envelope was grey, with a fine layer of dust. The words on the front were written in a scratchy blue ballpoint pen. The handwriting as familiar as her own. She turned it over. It was sealed with a yellowing piece of sticky tape. When was it written? It felt old, like it was written years ago, but there was no way of knowing for sure. She wasn't going to open it. It was absolutely clear that she should not open it. She was the most decisive person she knew, and she'd already decided not to open the letter, so there was nothing more to think about. Although, honestly, if she did open it, what would be the big deal? Any woman would open it like a shot. She listed all her friends and what their responses would be if she were to ring them up right now and ask what they thought. Miriam Oppenheimer. Yep, open it. Erica Edgecliffe. Are you kidding? Open it right this second. Laura Marks. Yes, you should open it, and then you should read it out aloud to me. Sarah Sachs. There would be no point asking Sarah, because she was incapable of making a decision. If Cecilia asked her whether she wanted tea or coffee, she would sit for a full minute, her forehead furrowed as she agonized over the pros and cons of each beverage before finally saying, "Coffee." No, wait, tea. A decision like this one would give her a brain seizure. Mahalia Ramachandran. Absolutely not. It would be completely disrespectful to your husband. You must not open it. Mahalia could be a little too sure of herself at times with those huge brown ethical eyes. Cecilia left the letter sitting on the kitchen table and went to put the kettle on. Damn that Berlin Wall, and that Cold War, and whoever it was who sat there back in 1940, whenever it was, mulling over the problem of what to do with those ungrateful Germans. The guy who suddenly clicked his fingers and said, "Got it, by Jove. We'll build a great big bloody wall and keep the buggers in." Presumably he hadn't sounded like a British sergeant major. Esther would know who first came up with the idea for the Berlin Wall. Esther would probably be able to give her his date of birth. It would have been a man, of course. Only a man could come up with something so ruthless, so essentially stupid and yet brutally effective. Was that sexist? She filled the kettle, switched it on, and cleaned the droplets of water in the sink with a paper towel, so that it shone. One of the mums from school, who had three sons almost exactly the same ages as Cecilia's three daughters, had said that some remark Cecilia had made was a teeny-weeny bit sexist, just before they'd started the Fate Committee meeting last week. Cecilia couldn't remember what she'd said, but she'd only been joking. Anyway, weren't women allowed to be sexist for the next 2,000 years or so, until they'd evened up the score? Maybe she was sexist. The kettle boiled. She swirled an Earl Grey tea bag and watched the curls of black spread through the water like ink. There were worse things to be than sexist. For example, you could be the sort of person who pinched your fingers together while using the words teeny weeny. She looked at her tea and sighed. A glass of wine would be nice right now, but she'd given up alcohol for Lent. Only 6 days to go. She had a bottle of expensive Shiraz ready to open on Easter Sunday when 35 adults and 23 children were coming to lunch, so she'd need it. Although, of course, she was an old hand at entertaining. She hosted Easter, Mother's Day, Father's Day, and Christmas. John Paul had 5 younger brothers, all married with kids, so it was quite a crowd. Planning was the key. Meticulous planning. She picked up her tea and took it over to the table. Why had she given up wine for Lent? Polly was more sensible. She'd given up strawberry jam. Cecilia had never seen Polly show more than a passing interest in strawberry jam, although now, of course, she was always catching her standing at the open fridge staring at it longingly.
We've just heard The Husband's Secret by Leanne Moriarty.
readers, these thrillers have deeper, darker sides. I hope you've enjoyed discovering them as much as I've enjoyed researching them for you. For more titles as riveting as they are unique, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for journeying along with me today, and see you in 1 week for the next edition of The Book Report.